The year was 1872, and a promising young priest named William Hare was the secretary for foreign mission work for the Episcopal Church. The son of an Episcopal priest and grandson of an Episcopal bishop, William had spent nearly all of his formative years within and around the cities of New York and Philadelphia. And so it's unremarkable in some ways that the House of Bishops in 1872 would vote to elect William Hobart Hare as a bishop in the Episcopal Church. Unremarkable in that he was born, raised, trained, expected really to follow in the family footsteps. And yet remarkable because William Hobart Hare, newly elected the first missionary bishop of Niobrara, was only 34 years old and had never in his life been to the Dakota Territory. By his own admission, Bishop Hare was completely unprepared for what he faced. He had spent some brief time in Minnesota and Michigan, but the reports and news articles, the accounts from those who had been out west, did nothing to ready him for, say, the winter blizzards that plunged the temperature to minus 23 degrees, making visitations within the diocese on horseback or in open wagon a tremendous challenge. And little in his formal training had equipped him for the radical cultural encounter he experienced with the Lakota and the Dakota with whom he served. It wasn't as if other members of the Christian faith hadn't faced this before. The history of our Christian faith with the natives of North America repeats nearly the same story over and over again. The destruction of culture in favor of civilization has been witnessed in the eradication of native language, worship, food, dress, anything that gives one meaning. It is heartrending that at nearly every turn, when the cross follows the sword, misery has ensued. Painfully, regretfully, in the church, we have been caught up in the machinations of empire. Time after time, we have allowed ourselves to be yet another tool of the oppressor. Maybe that's what makes this story remarkable. It's not that Bishop Hare didn't suffer from the then culturally acceptable racism that pervaded every interaction with the heathen. It's just that this was not the stance that Bishop Hare, and in general, the Episcopal Church adopted in the Diocese of Niobrara, now the two dioceses of North and South Dakota. Remarkably, the good news of Jesus Christ was offered humbly within the context of relationship. Bishop Hare paid close attention to the customs of the Sioux. He found common ground, seeing their practices of gift-giving, of insistence upon the common good as the means for God's Spirit to be known. Through this, he offered witness, intent upon recognizing the movements of the already present Spirit in new places, and thereby allowing the Christian faith to be changed in the process. Paul stood in the Areopagus, the very center of intellectual life in Athens. The Areopagus, known in English as Mars Hill, was a first century sprawl plaza meets Senate floor with side of county courthouse. It was a forum for those Greeks who had always been known for their interest, their devotion really, to philosophy and the pursuit of new ideas. So when this babbler, that's what they called Paul, when this babbler came into town talking about Jesus the Christ that had been resurrected from the dead, he was brought onto Athens' center stage amongst the philosophers and theologians of all kinds to explain himself. And what follows next is remarkable, for there are plenty of instances in the Acts of the Apostles and in Paul's letters where Paul makes a spirited and often confrontational defense of Jesus the Christ. And yet, in the midst of shrines to all sorts of deities, Paul does not go on the attack. He enters into dialogue. He pays attention. He finds common ground. And then, and only then, does he offer witness. There is a young Anglo-Catholic priest in the Church of England named Ian Mobsby. Ian is part of a group of young priests that is seeking to lead people into living out the gospel in ways that the traditional church has been scared, unwilling, or simply hasn't had the imagination to try. Several years ago, he became fascinated by the posters and the glossy postcards around London for spirit fairs. Somewhat like our psychic fairs here in Berkeley, you'll find down on Gilman. Spirit fairs in England are conventions of those interested in experiencing spirituality, maybe knowing more about it, or simply hawking their spiritual wares. At one such spirit fair a few years ago, there was a booth, and in that booth, there was a gong. A gong that had been reportedly carried to that fair from the Himalayas themselves. It was a large and beautiful gong with an impressively decorated mallet. To bang on this gong and feel its reverberations was to be transported. At least that's what the sign said. And to be transported, all one had to do was pay $45 for one hit. If it were me, I would want to bang that gong very slowly. There were also rocks of many kinds in another booth that provided healing, and in another booth, demonstrations of all sorts of physical practices to align oneself. And in yet another one of the booths, there was Father Ian Mobsby, dressed in all black with his clergy collar. And with him were prayer cards with a striking photograph on the front and on the back, a simple prayer for a difficult time in one's life. And next to those prayer cards were simple, beautiful prayer beads with another card about how to use them. And Ian's booth was packed. People were fascinated by the practices that he offered. They wanted to talk with him about what it was like to pray in this way. Without saying a word, Ian seemed to be speaking from the top of Mars Hill. I see how extremely religious you are in every way. I have seen that some of you have shrines for an unknown God. I too have this hunger, and through these ways I have come to know this God, this Jesus the Christ, who has been raised from the dead. So often we strike out at that which we do not understand, especially when that person or belief calls into question our own beliefs and practices. This has always been the cry against syncretism. Over the centuries, especially when reformers were facing a deeply flawed church, just the use of the word syncretism became pejorative, a dirty byword in many theological circles. Originally used by Plutarch and others to mean a coming together to oppose an external force, the concept of syncretism also has been understood as the forming of an alliance. And yet opponents of syncretism have always been afraid that when new ideas or ways of being come into contact with time-honored belief, that the essence of that belief will necessarily be polluted. That this belief's fundamental truth will be inevitably, tragically changed. Generation upon generation of the Christian church bear the scars of these family brawls. And what I find fascinating about Christianity is that within one generation, the Christian faith was already being practiced in a language that its founder never spoke and in places far, far from its homeland. Within one generation. From its very beginning, Christianity has encountered cultures, ideas, symbols, and practices that were not present at its start. For this reason, through its spread, the gospel has been received differently in every place that it has been proclaimed. The good news hasn't changed, but the people and the context reverberate with the story in a way that sounds different every time with every telling. The good news that Jesus, whose death had filled his disciples with fear, was known to be alive again, and the promise to us that we are not orphaned, that we are not left alone. This good news may indeed sound different in Berkeley, California in 2011. And yet, friends, Berkeley, California is not that different from Athens, Greece, nearly 2,000 years ago. There are still very many smart people searching for the newest way of knowing. There are still many spiritual people hungering, starving to connect with the God they perceive but do not know. We can still see these shrines to this all over this town. My guess is we walk past them every day. Which are the altars, the objects of worship to an unknown God that we see? What do they look like? What are the inscriptions on them? What are these people hoping for? It would have been unremarkable if Bishop William Hobart Hare had solely sought to destroy Lakota culture, replacing it with the values, practices, and beliefs of the American Northeastern civilization of 1873. It would have been unremarkable if Paul had begun his address on Mars Hill, "You ignorant Athenians, you think you're so smart, but clearly by looking at your shrines, you're not. You don't get it at all." It would have been unremarkable if Ian Mobsby had gone to the spiritual fair and picketed those who were giving their hard-earned cash to bang a gong or buy a crystal or claim some inner peace with a credit card. But each of these followers of Christ chose a different witness. What would be remarkable is if we really paid attention to those who gather at those altars, met them where they are, helped them to make meaning of the glimpses of Jesus that they already see and feel. In a world littered with destructive reactions to the Spirit who moves in strange and wonderful ways, that would be remarkable.